Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Evangelical Dark Web. Tonight, we're going to be diving into some recent news, but as well as looking back on how it relates to history and stuff like that. And part of my thesis tonight is, you know, MLK led to Don Lemon. That's part of it. Another part of it is that the tide of MLK has turned. The vibe shift has gone in the opposite direction as far as he is concerned. I think that's not only happening, you know, with the culture at large, also among evangelicals as well. So that's sort of the topic at hand for tonight, the two pillars that I kind of want to discuss. So I don't know if you have any opening thoughts that you want to give before I kind of dive into some of the history of the matter.
Yeah, so one thing I would say is that this might actually be a little bit of an issue that the church might have led the way on rather than the church reacting to the culture, though I do think the culture on its own did accelerate the revision or correction on MLK. But the church has for years, in terms of combating Black Lives Matter and the CRT, gone after MLK on his heresies. So, and again, Virgil Walker, to his credit, being one of the players in this space that is for years, going back even to, like, I want to say 2018, around the MLK 50 stuff, where the church was, where you actually had people combating the Trinitarian errors and all the denial of inerrancy and all the other heresies that MLK had adopted. So people fought on him as a pastor and a minister before they necessarily fought against him and his movement and everything his movement stood for.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you bring that up. I'm going to be honest, like, I did not really play a role, like, Evangelical Dark Web didn't really play a role in debunking the MLK narrative, and part of that is lack of interest. With Dietrich Bonhoeffer, we will have played a role in that when that eventually comes down the pike, you know, when the normies kind of wake up to that, we would have played a role. But for MLK, like, back to Dietrich Bonhoeffer, it was interesting. Like, I had historical intrigue in looking it up. And then, like, at the end, it's like, how is this even a question? He was definitely a heretic. He was a theological liberal. He was even more liberal than Karl Barth, who's already recognized by liberals at the Gospel Coalition as too liberal for them. So he's too liberal for Karl Barth, who was too liberal for the Gospel Coalition, who was too liberal for, you know, what Christians should be. So, multiple degrees of too liberal, but nevertheless is celebrated because, you know, his death feeds a narrative, and MLK is much the same way, except it's not historically intriguing. And I think the groundwork and the evidence is so overwhelming and so crystal clear that MLK is not a believer. He was a false teacher because he did bear the, you know, the title of reverend and stuff like that. That it's not even an interesting question whether MLK was a false teacher. But, you know, you mentioned Virgil Walker. I want to give a couple other shout-outs. Pulpit and Penn did their part for years. You know, Jeff Maples and Dissenter did their part for years. And I guess Stone Choir, I don't know, you know, again, they might have been later to the game on MLK, but at least they did the same thing.
But all that's to say is,
like, the groundwork was already done by the time I even was interested. Like, last year I was interested in writing about it, but it was like I just did not have the interest in doing the research because I just thought it was too easy.
Last year was the Trump inauguration, so that kind of took a lot more precedence and importance than MLK, as it should.
Oh, yeah. And that's the other thing. Like, that's the other thing. So last year, the MLK riot, or not MLK, last year Trump was inaugurated on the federal holiday. And so that pretty much made it very easy for the holiday to get overlooked because, you know, the adults are back in charge of the country. And that has definitely proven to be the case 1 year later. So this year, I do believe that the riots in Minneapolis undercut MLK in the celebration and festivities. I think that there's a direct correlation between, you know, very few, not as many Republicans celebrating MLK Day as there used to be, in part because of the riots, and it's just so obviously connected in ways, shapes, and forms to MLK's movement, including the fact that today, or let's just give a little bit of setup, they the climax being they disrupted, you know, after Renee Good, that is. She was a bit of a climax in the riots in Minneapolis. But they disrupted a church service of City's Church in Minneapolis, Minnesota, which was a surprisingly based church because, you know, the guy who worked, one of their pastors is, in fact, you know, with the Border Patrol and stuff like that, and ICE or whatever. So pretty based, actually. Like, that church was, forgive me, City's Church, you know, I was not familiar with your game and how based you were. But anyway, that was a bit of a watershed moment that should be a wake-up call for many in the churches that, hey, we are looking at, if liberals get back in charge, we are looking at Spanish Civil War. That is what we're looking at. Except, you know, I think back then they would have been the Republicans in the Spanish Civil War instead of the monarchist or, you know, the Franco side, the good guys. But anyway, that would be the only irony of the situation, is that the Republicans would not be the baddies in this American context. Just the weak leadership in many such cases. So, you have any thoughts that you want to add to that as far as the connection between, like, this year, what's going on in Minneapolis and MLK as a holiday, legacy?
I mean, I think it obviously plays a role, but I think the culmination of, like, the subdued MLK from the right is that's years in the works. And again, I kind of said already, like, I think the theological side happened first, and now you're getting we're done with the Civil Rights Act and the civil rights regime. Those narratives have now taken ground and taken root in the Republican Party. I mean, again, Christopher Caldwell, Age of Entitlement, did a great work on it. And he goes into the detailed history that, you know, the civil rights movement was not popular in the 60s, that race relations got worse as the decade went on, as they got more concessions. And a lot of the support for civil rights was actually rooted in almost like an anti-Southern sentiment. Like, they thought the South was very antiquated. They were backwards, you know, kind of like an East-West versus, or, you know, like Northeast and the West Coast versus the South kind of dynamic happening. And again, no one anticipated that the Civil Rights Act would become what it is today.
Along those lines, like, the South did not really become cool until, like, ZZ Top and the 80s and stuff like that. Like, it took a while. Like, we live in a world where the South is cool now. Like, that is objectively the case. SEC dominating football until the last few years and stuff like that. Yeah, the South was cool. The South is cool. But, you know, before, say, the 80s, ZZ Top and all that, the South was not considered.
Yeah, they were considered a backwater. And again, it took like 100 years for a lot of the wealth from the Civil War, or War of Northern Aggression, as some call it, to be recouped by the South. And it did not help that, like, this is the Federal Reserve's fault, is that there's one interest rate for the entire country, because that helps states like California. It hurts states like Mississippi. And both those two states, I want to say, were similar in size in like the year 1900. So because California had access to cheap money and they were, again, a huge hub for the military and specifically anything with aviation, they got a huge boon of economic development versus Mississippi, which basically has to pay the same interest rate and did not get that. So, I mean, again, so they were also economically disadvantaged.
That's an interesting argument that might be a little more big brain than I'm ready for. Because that just brings up a lot of things that I could totally go down that rabbit hole and just ask, you know, what is solution to that?
But the South was very much disadvantaged. They were very much viewed as backwater. And, you know, people didn't anticipate the Civil Rights Act affecting their state. They thought it would just affect them.
Yeah, and same with the Voting Rights Act, which affects all of us because they created these DEI districts. Which affect the balance of power in Congress and gave the Democrats a huge advantage.
But we're going into more of how the narrative, I think, has collapsed. So you have, again, that's all from Christopher Caldwell's book.
Charlie Kirk. Stuff, you had Charlie Kirk before Charlie dying. Kirk.
2024, too. Like, so that's, you know, 2 years ago.
So Charlie Kirk, J.D. Vance, Donald Trump has recently said some things against the Civil Rights Act. So there's a lot of sentiment growing on the right against the Civil Rights Act.
Again, shout out to Jeremy Carl, Unprotected Class, another book that laid a lot of the groundwork.
Also shout out to John Doyle, because he was also very early to the MLK conversation and just saying, hey, this guy was a, you know, an astroturfed communist.
Yeah, and his video this week on the his five favorite race riots. I mean, again, I had heard of two of them, one of them being the Harlem riot, which that actually, I want to say, was timed around the Civil Rights Act passing. So the Civil Rights Act passed, and then you get like 2 weeks later, this, you know, black guy committing crime in Harlem and get shot by police. Same thing. And again, you realize, again, this is in Caldwell's book, you realize that BLM has always existed from the 60s. You know, black guy commits crime, gets shot by police. Black people react with violence and claim he was unarmed and innocent. And often the perpetrators on the younger side. Again, many such cases. The same stuff that happened with Freddie Gray and Michael Brown and George Floyd happened in the 60s as well. Like, the behavior was exactly the same. And then you repeat it again in the 90s with Rodney King and then O.J. Simpson. So, again, the fact that the MLK narrative lasted as long as it did is kind of a, you know, testament to the, I guess, political ineptitude. Well, yeah, well, ineptitude. That they failed to realize that the parallels were the same, especially in the 90s when it's like white Americans should have realized, oh, they acquitted a guy of murder because he was black.
Yeah, because like all, like most of my childhood to a, you know, early adult life, the narrative was, oh, the prosecutors screwed up. They were uniquely bad. And O.J. Simpson's lawyers were uniquely good, which even if you want to grant those points, you know, reasonable doubt is the standard. And, you know, wasn't it Dave Chappelle who had the skit of unreasonable doubt?
Yes.
And stuff like that. So let's just be real. At the end of the day, that was a jury nullification. There's another instance of jury nullification that happened with, like, the guy who put a hit out, like a bounty on a someone ranking in ICE.
And that was recent.
That was today, recently. The acquittal.
Yes.
It was like today. So Bovino was the guy, not the criminal's name, but the officer, the Patriot's name. And I think he gave a press conference or whatever, you know, aura farming, that guy is. But anyway, like, the left believes in jury nullification. They believe that, you know, it does not matter what the law says. It does not matter right or wrong. We like that person. We're acquitting them. You know, and that's a struggle with, you know, city of Baltimore. You know, bring up a local example. It's like, how do you convict people in, you know, a Baltimore jury? That's an issue there. And it's also an issue anytime you get illegal aliens on trial. If you get a bunch of liberals on there, they're just going to acquit. Doesn't matter if they murder. Doesn't matter if it's a sex crime. Doesn't matter what they did. Liberals are acquitting these people in these politically motivated crimes. So that'll be very interesting. The Carmelo Anthony trial should be coming up sometime this year.
And again, the Carmelo Anthony and then DeCarlos, I want to say it's DeCarlos Brown, who killed Irina Zaruska. So you had a couple of high profile cases last year of, you know, black on white violence that was entirely senseless. And that's not even including whoever it was that, you know, ignited the dude on the New York City subway. So it's just like, you have just random and senseless acts of violence from black people that, you know, in the past would have resulted in riots, that, you know, there would have been mobs with pitchforks and probably some rope and some trees. And that's the type of stuff that, you know, would have happened in the past, that, you know, and there's not actually sensible justice for today because you have Democrat prosecutors letting people go, letting them back onto the streets. You have
Democrat judges apparently won't let charges move forward on Don Lemon. And maybe I'm a little antiquated on my understanding, like judges don't indict people. So I'm a little confused by that. Pam Bondi, can Pam Bondi explain that one to me? I'm glad that we're perp walking a bunch of, you know, other activists. I do want the Don Lemon to go to prison, even though he probably loves prison. But, solitary confinement then. But anyway, Yeah, I'm kind of confused as to why a judge holds up an indictment when,
well, I mean, they could
grand juries, or they could do a preliminary hearing.
They could go through the federal grand jury. The indictment would, you signing off on the complaint would then go to a preliminary hearing. So there is, I guess they did that because it was quicker versus the federal grand jury, which they are doing that against Tim Wallace and company. So
yeah, I get the hate around Pam Bondi, and believe me, I believe she's doing a terrible job as well. But some of this stuff does take time. Like, you know, they couldn't do it on Monday because it was a federal holiday. Good luck getting anything moving on a federal holiday. But, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday, now Thursday, okay, we got some arrest. That's a good thing. That is a good thing. And you know, we want to see more of that. We want to encourage what we see. Celebrate the W's, demand more. Like, that is how we do it. That is how we have to chimp out in this situation. But Don Lemon should be arrested, and we shouldn't be letting judges hold that up. So with that said, like, Don Lemon, MLK, I mean, Don Lemon's a little less of a, not as good of an orator, definitely a lot more homosexual, you know, especially if the allegations regarding MLK regarding that are true. You know, if the allegations of him being gay are also true, just saying, Don Lemon's still more. But even so, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement is a spitting image, as you've established quite well.
Yeah.
I mean, spitting image of the 1960s race riots.
And 1990s.
And the 1990s, yeah.
I mean, so, again, the O.J. Simpson's case should have been, especially with all the documentaries they've made on O.J., because, like, ESPN's 30 for 30 connects it to Wyatt riots, which, again, another famous riot from the 60s. Same thing as the Harlem riots, same thing as George Floyd, same thing as Michael Brown. And same thing as, literally, I think it was very similar in details to Rodney King. So,
yeah, the fact that it's taken so long for the American right to kind of wake up to this, although to some degree, there was a time when Republicans resisted the idea of celebrating MLK with a holiday. Like, I don't know if it was Reagan that made it a thing or not, but like there was, like, I remember, wasn't it John McCain? Like, yes, one base thing that John McCain did was resist MLK Day as a holiday during his earlier days in the Senate. You know, and he was apologizing for that in, like, 2008. So, you know, the guy clearly knew, you know, he clearly went soft on the issue, on the character of the person. And I believe, like, the reason why it was delayed as a holiday was because of the tapes and stuff like that. Or what people believed was on the tapes, which, you know, turns out to be, you know, probably as bad as people think it is. So, you know, the FBI was spying on him, probably not legal. But I also kind of don't care at this point, because should the FBI be monitoring the activists in the country?
No, especially when he's associated with a communist named Stanley Levinson, who was credited with writing several of his speeches.
Small hat gang. But also worth noting that, you know, spying on communists, not wrong. And yeah. So with that said,
well, it has come
into the, oh, okay.
Let me give the last thing that I think is really contributing to the MLK sentiment is the job situation. Because again, DEI programs have been implemented for over a decade at scale. So, and then of course you have the Bloomberg article or study, which basically said 91% of the people hired in the Fortune 100, which is not every top 100 company, but I think like 91 or 94, were basically DEI hires. And that would be, and again, a lot of those were probably H-1Bs who are stealing the jobs from white people. Again, it breaks it down by company. So it's not like it's just Amazon warehouse workers being minorities. It's, you know, you can individualize it by company. So a lot of financial sector jobs went to DEI hires. So when you're combining the DEI hires with constant like racial strife from various minority groups, and while actively denying white men opportunity in this country, you're going to have a massive backlash on, hey, we're the ones being denied opportunity, and the Civil Rights Act is the ultimate culprit behind why this is happening. Because you're basically giving every other group an advantage but white people. And let's be honest, which group of people built the country single-handedly?
And that's also what ties into like speaking of, you know, we mentioned J.D. Vance, Charlie Kirk, even Donald Trump, Pete Hegseth for getting rid of the SBA 8 thing, which is a basically you have these codes with the SBA. You can get these codes with the SBA. So like you're this type of business minority owner or whatever. And they're basically saying these codes will not matter for federal contracts. And that is the fight that's going on right now, is that they're trying to eliminate DEI contracting
for
the government. Which basically federal contracting is how the federal government gets anything done.
Yeah, which again, just to give an image, you have a contract for, let's say, $50 million. And you need to hire a minority owned business. You hire them for $50 million and the minority business subcontracts it out to another contractor, a major contractor. And all of a sudden, and so they're just literally a pass through. And that's supposed to, like, the federal government is literally wasting money doing this.
Right. So bad things are happening. And
I mean, it's like a mafia racketeering.
And, yeah, it's getting caught out. The backlash is here. It's like, hey, we tried the Civil Rights Act. It has not benefited the United States whatsoever. It's made cities unlivable.
Yeah, that's before we even discuss the cities being unlivable.
So this week, Jason Whitlock, to his credit, hosted the debate on this. You know, it's nice to see the black community on the right have a conversation about this. It featured Delano Squires.
And Whitlock has also largely changed on this issue. Because, again, when he first launched his show at The Blaze, he was pro-MLK. And now he's come around on that.
Yeah. So, and he definitely seemed to have sided with Chad Johnson. Right? No, his name actually Chad Johnson. I really got to make sure I'm not confused. Chad Jackson. Jackson. Like, Chad Johnson's a football player. OJ Cinco. But, they don't all have the same last names. But anyway, he hosted a debate between those two. Jackson has put out a documentary on MLK. I've not yet seen it. But anyway, he's put out a documentary. Delano Squires has written for The Blaze a lot and is a less frequent contributor on Fearless with Jason Whitlock than he used to be. But maybe he's more on the Harmony channel, which is where this debate originally live streamed at. So I've watched all 2.5 hours of it. We're not going to watch that long of a clip, but there is one section in particular that I want to show because I think it's very indicative of the conversation. It does encompass a lot, like the theological component, as well as the was he a communist or not? Like, that's kind of the question. So they're debating whether MLK Jr., this is one of the five questions that they had. I think they only got to four of the questions, but one of them was, you know, was MLK Jr. a socialist, a Marxist, or just a critic of the ills of capitalism? And this part of the debate I thought was really good. So, you know, as far as the representative samples of this debate, this is what I thought. We're going to do this at 1.5 speed because it's Jason Whitlock. It's, you know, everyone's like kind of a slow talker on that show. But anyway.
Exactly that.
Again, I think you are making a conclusion where an argument needs to be. At a certain point, you have to have evidence, and the evidence can't be, well, he's lying, therefore that proves that he's a communist. That just doesn't hold to me. Again, I'm not saying that King or anybody else in the civil rights movement had to say I am a communist. That would be silly. You and I, because, you know, we would agree on that. But I'm looking for the markers. Now, if you said, hey, Dr. King advocated for sort of a classless, stateless society, if he advocated for the abolition of religion or the abolition of the family, then I can say, okay, now we're on to something. I've never heard you say those things. What I do hear you do is engage in guilt by association. And again, my question is this a principle that you carry across the board? I'm an equal weights and measures kind of guy. Because it is easy to say, well, this person advised this other person, and because of that, the person being advised therefore automatically adopts the entire ideology of the advisor. I don't know if that's an argument that can be sustained as you carry that through time. So again, I've seen and heard you do this often, right? It'll be, no, King won't say he's a communist. He says, in fact, that Christianity and communism are incompatible. Your response would be, well, he plagiarized that speech. My response would be, okay, strange tactic for a person who believes something and really wants to see something happen, to publicly say, no, I don't believe in this thing, and these are the reasons why. And this is why I go back to answering the original question, whether I think King was a Marxist, socialist, or a critic of capitalism. Certainly he was a critic of capitalism. Everybody is. Democrats, Republicans, I mean, they just criticize it in different ways. But if the bar is that any critique or criticism of capitalism makes you a Marxist, then what I'm saying is you're going to sweep in far more people than you realize.
I apologize again, but I think he's arguing more than he would criticize capitalism. He's saying that he's part of his argument is guilt by association. You run with communists, avowed communists. I'll apologize for using my stupid analogies again, but it's like, man, I used to run around. I had friends that were pimps.
Mm-hmm.
And when I ran around with them, you could make some assumptions about me that would be actually true.
Is one of them that you were a pimp?
If someone made that assumption, I would deny it, but I go, I see why you're making that assumption.
Mm. Of course you deny it. That's what pimps do. You see where this goes?
I got it. I couldn't be offended by it because I'm running around with guys that were pimps.
Mm-hmm.
And so if people wanted to draw all kinds of conclusions about me because of that and what I think about, what I thought about prostitution and all that other stuff, like Whitlock must be in support of prostitution. He runs around with pimps. And so if people looked at me and you know, I'm not Dr. King, I'm not some huge religious leader, but I do promote Christianity.
Well, that part.
And so if today, if I'm still running around with them same guys, and that's still who I'm talking to most often, rather than Virgil and other people, and my friends haven't changed, I wouldn't blame people. Man, Whitlock, you know, guilt by association, I kind of believe it. My father believed in it. You need to quit running with them Negroes, but they into this and that. Everybody I know believes that. But anyway, I don't.
No, no, and I think you actually hit the nail on the head, but I do have a question for you, Delano.
Sure.
Obviously, this is part of one of the.
That's the first part of this exchange I wanted to share. Your reaction to that?
Well, I mean, the whole guilt by association thing, oh, you criticize capitalism, so therefore you're socialist. I mean, that's like a James Lindsay level rhetoric. But at the same time, I mean,
it wasn't just criticizing capitalism as guilt, as the association. It was you run around with, you know, all these people that MLK hung around with were communists.
I mean, you can call it communism or socialism or whatever. I don't necessarily think King's personal ideology was as rigid. It was just, oh, white people have and we want. You know, they have, again, he would probably support reparations. It was, oh, we need more money for social welfare programs, which again was what the civil rights movement notoriously did in all the cities. And again, John Doyle kind of details this in his video where, you know, they would basically extort the government for, you know, social resources and money and more programs to help elevate their community. So again, they were for getting what is functionally, you know, racial wealth redistribution is white people pay taxes and then those taxes go towards minority like welfare programs. I mean, you can call that communism, socialism, doesn't really matter, but that was the economic policy that MLK was for, along with like racial quotas and jobs and stuff. So again, call that what you want to call it, but it's not necessarily just a critique of capitalism.
But I do think, you know, guilt by association is not complete evidence. But here's the thing. If he is yoked to avowed communist, what do you think that makes him? So I do
I mean,
think
he wasn't.
And the fact that Jason Whitlock bringing his, you know, hood rat example into it, I thought brought the necessary levity, but also clarity to this discussion. Because he absolutely nailed it.
It's not like he was investigated for no reason.
Right. So the next part's where we get into the more theological part. Even though it's not the Christian section of the debate, he does preemptively ask about it.
And it's not, it's not like the Soviets weren't trying to elevate racial tensions in America.
Right. Which is one of the things that Jackson brings that up. Jackson brings up the fact that the Soviet Union viewed the civil rights movement, NAACP and all that as a method for, you know, infiltrating the United States ideologically.
Which unironically was portrayed on the show The Americans, which is about Soviet spies. In the 1980s, they had a backstory where they infiltrated the civil rights movement in the 60s. So
this is the next portion where they preemptively ask, because it's not the MLK as a Christian debate part of the debate, but it is preemptively asked because of something Delano Squires said in MLK's defense.
Five questions that we are going to get to, but was Martin Luther King a Christian?
You want to skip down there?
No, I'm going somewhere with this. But
do I believe he was a Christian?
Yes, was he a Christian?
The stated views on core Christian doctrine that I've seen from Dr. King, from the writing of his own hands, put him, in my perspective, outside of biblical orthodoxy. If he never repented from those views, then I would not see him as someone who was spiritually regenerate. Okay. So I would answer that question in the negative. If he never repented. Okay. I don't know where he was on his last days. I don't know how his views evolved from when he was in seminary. But again, but I actually believe what he writes.
So if by what you just said, if King wasn't a Christian, what then do you want me to do with the statement that you just put out there that King said that there's no companionship between Christianity and communism? What am I to do with that if he wasn't a Christian?
I don't think you have to be a Christian to make that argument.
So what am I to do with it then?
I mean, you could either believe it or not believe it.
No, clarify your question. I don't fully understand. What are you to do with it? What do you mean? You're saying it's incompatible.
Right. So he said earlier that King said Christianity is incompatible with communism. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, King's not a Christian. You're saying he's not a Christian, so he's actually very compatible with communism.
Precisely. That's exactly the point. So if what am I to do with this argument that, well, King said that there's no companionship between Christianity and communism, that they're incompatible. And you say that to say what exactly?
I'm saying that to say that the charge that you level against him of being a Marxist.
But it insinuates that he's a Christian, though.
He may very well have seen himself that way. You're asking me to judge his sort of spiritual fitness 60 plus years after, you know, he drew his last breath. I mean, all I can go on is the things that he said. So if I hear somebody who says, no, I profess to be a Christian, but I reject, you know, substitutionary atonement, I object the bodily resurrection of Christ, I would say, that don't sound Christian to me. Now, I think these are slightly different things, because someone can feel that they're a true believer, right? Someone can be, but then that's a different question, because God is the ultimate judge. And what I'm saying is someone can be sincere in their beliefs, but their faith not be genuine.
That's why we have the word. That's why we have the Bible.
Right. But none of that discounts the fact that he was making a claim that one of the core tenets of communism is the rejection of organized religion. It's not just ambivalent to organized religion, it's hostile to it. And he was writing that this is one of the reasons why communism and Christianity are incompatible. Now, your response to that is almost never, or not just, oh, King wasn't a Christian. Your response to that is he plagiarized it and he was lying. But what I'm saying is, when King writes about his theological views, which you and I would both argue put him outside of biblical orthodoxy, those things you believe.
Yeah, it's actually a moot argument, because the thing is, again, like, yes, I do tend to go to he plagiarized that, because he did. I mean, anybody can go read the book right now. It was written in 1951 by Robert J. McCracken, called Questions People Ask, specifically on the question of communism. If you read what he said, and if you read what King would later say about it in 1957, and then throughout the remainder of his years, he's actually copying, in some cases verbatim, and then in other cases, ideas that originated with McCracken. And so that's a disingenuous piece, as far as I'm concerned, because when you look at the fact that communists are utilitarians, and not only that, they lift ideas and they lift talking points and slogans from all over the place. It's kind of like an amalgamation of different things to kind of get into the good graces of the people. That is in fact the ultimate goal. Let me say the thing that's going to resonate with the most people to then push a sinister agenda. That's part of their framework. That's part of what they do. Lenin himself said that it is not above us to lie, to steal, to do whatever we can, so long as we can push our goal, push our agenda. And of course, I'm paraphrasing him. But again, King was part of this kind of this framework. He was part of this kind of milieu. And to say, Delano, I'm going to put this out there one last time. To say, well, King said that communism and Christianity are incompatible. The insinuation when such an argument is made that King himself was a Christian, therefore, he was saying that there's no way that he can actually have companionship with communists. There's no way that he can actually have camaraderie with people who possess who hold to or who are devotees to the communist ideology or the communist agenda. That's the insinuation that's being made. And so that's the reason why this kind of association piece is important. I understand that in academia, the fallacy of guilt by association is typically dismissed. I understand that. But here, it actually does apply, because per you, King himself said that there's no companionship between Christianity. There's no compatibility between Christianity and communism. So why is it that the number one financier of the Communist Party and of Soviet action in America, why is that the leader or basically your most trusted advisor? You don't have to take my word for it. Again, go read Dangerous Friendship. Again, somebody who's not ideologically on my side wrote the book. You can actually get into the kind of inner circle, the kind of inner conversations between the two of them. Why is it, according to the most recently released FBI files, you find that there's a line of communication between the SELC and the USSR, communicating by way of Soviet intelligence assets, communicating by way of intermediaries? Why is there that connection there? And again, King knew about this. It wasn't as though he was just this hopeless, this blind, deaf, and dumb puppet who didn't know anything. Who, you know what I mean? He understood the connections that Levinson had, and that's exactly why he was so willing to trust him as an advisor. Go where he say go, do what he say do, say what he said say.
So he was a puppet. I mean,
he was a puppet, but he wasn't a blind puppet. He was fully aware of what was going on.
In any of these FBI communications, do we have Dr. King on record as, again, stating he either wants to abolish the family, abolish organized religion, a complete federalization of industry, a classless or stateless society? Is there any evidence of that in the secret, not the public, in the secret communications?
Yes, of course.
You're muted.
I don't know how much you want to get into that. You want to keep going with that, but that is a, I think that that exchange was like a body knockout blow for Delano Squires. Like, I thought that that was, you know, that was a knockdown. I think both parts, the guilt by association argument, I think landed really well. And then the, you know, if King's not a Christian, then him saying that Christianity and communism are incompatible is moot. It just is entirely moot. So, your reaction to that?
I mean, again, you know, Delano's operating from like an older, you know, framework that's largely been discredited, outdated, and you know, the movement is largely moving on from where he's coming from. I mean, you could debate whether how he described himself from an economic standpoint. And again, the whole point on, was he about abolishing the family, the classist society, or all of that, but it doesn't necessarily matter because
you know who was? Black Lives Matter.
Yeah. But a lot of times the people that call themselves communist in like the third world and stuff, they're just doing that because it gets them power. You know, this is the literal accelerationism, is we're going to use communism as a tool to get power, political power, and also assistance from the Soviets. And then from there, we're going to, you know, take over the country, nationalize all the industries, because again, you can't have competing factions. So again, it's more of just a means to an end for a lot of like, you know, people in the third world and stuff that aren't necessarily diehard ideologues. It's just, okay, communism gets them power, which then allows them to seize the assets of their enemies.
Yeah, I don't think the African National Congress or the Zimbabweans or whatever were really ideologically fluent in, you know, the finer points of communism.
They don't care what Karl Marx did or did not say.
They probably never read Lenin either.
They're interested in taking what, you know, in South Africa, what the Boers and the British or the former Brits had in Rhodesia. They just wanted to take over Rhodesia and, you know, take the land from the white farmers. Like, that's what they were interested in. It doesn't matter whether what Marx did or didn't say. They're not necessarily pure ideological communists. They're just there to take again, it's anti-imperialism.
It's also an entire worldview built on envy and coveting what other people have.
Yeah, envy and resentment. That's it.
Like, it's not, in most of the third world, it's not deeper than that. So.
And again, in some parts, it's strictly just, oh, this family wants to rule this country, therefore they align themselves with the communists. That's what Vietnam was. It wasn't like pure strict, you know, we want to be communists. It's like, okay, I'm on the side of the Soviets, they're on the side of the Americans, and we're gonna fight out the war, and you know, we're gonna be communists because that's who's backing us.
And that's probably why it didn't really work out. Like, you know, strict communism didn't really work out in Vietnam,
and they're technically
the Chinese would have hoped. But I will say that the ideological components of communism, I do think, took hold in China and North Korea. I do think that that is where it took hold. Obviously, it took hold in Russia. Like, the ideological component took hold in Russia. I think that's true. And, you know, this does matter in terms of, I don't want to be, like, too broad with the term revolution, but, you know, American Revolution, right? You know, ideas mattered. But ultimately, what mattered more than ideas is the fact that the colonies had communities, they had associations, they were, the ability to organize was actually far more important than the ideas that they fought for, because the ideas that they fought for also existed in other British colonies like Halifax and stuff like that, like the Canadian islands and stuff, Nova Scotia, Halifax, all these other places that the British Empire still ruled. Quebec, but a little less because they were a little too Frenchy, but all these places, the same ideas are still floating around. And along those lines, the same ideas still floated around, but why did the revolution happen in the 13 colonies, but not Halifax? Why is that? Because it wasn't necessarily about the ideas. It was about, we have this community here and we want to govern as that. and a little bit of rugged individualism that some of those Canadian islands didn't really have. So going, you know, and the French Revolution, very idealistic. Napoleon, he saved the French Revolution from itself, but again, the guy was thoroughly entrenched in the political, you know, aspects of it. He was a little bit of a Republican philosopher for his time, you know, early on. He has very young political writings. So, yes, in the first world, I think that a lot of the ideas of a revolution matter. But in the third world, I don't think it does. I think it's no deeper than envy and stuff like that. And, you know, you're saying that, you know, to some degree, the civil rights movement wasn't much different.
Well, and no, even, I mean, yeah.
And even MLK's speeches, which, to answer Sanders' question, yes, they, you know, a lot of them were written by the usual suspects. You mentioned the guy's name earlier in the live stream.
And they did mention it in the debate clip.
Right. And there's a lot of, you know, some veiled threats kind of in a lot of his speeches. So even though MLK says, you know, we don't want our movement to devolve into violence, he's not really all that condemning of the race riots of the 1960s in the I Have a Dream speech. You know, well, he says, again, I Have a Dream, we're going to have these things. And, you know.
Well, the I Have a Dream speech is inherently anti-white. And if you actually sat down and read the text, and he's talking about, oh, the founding fathers of America, you know, wrote a promissory note that was marked insufficient funds. He's basically accusing the founding fathers of failing to realize their vision for America. And again, that's anti-white. That's anti-American.
Another thing to point out. Founding fathers
succeeded in their generation.
Another thing to point out about the, well, first of all, the Declaration of Independence was not a promissory note of the United States.
Well, yeah, but it also...
There's a preamble in that document that was written to appeal to the French.
Well, the Declaration also used the word consanguinity, which basically means shared blood or common blood. So again, it wasn't inclusive of the slaves in its contents.
But even so, like, the ideas expressed were designed to appeal to the French. We wanted the French to be allies in the Revolutionary War. It succeeded, by the way, a few years later. So,
but again, the notion that, like, oh, the ideas of America were failed to be realized until the Civil Rights Act is ridiculous. That's honestly, that's offensive. That's anti-white. That's anti-American.
It is anti-American.
That is the essence of the I Have a Dream speech.
And that is ultimately what is taught in public schools, that America did not really live up to its ideals until, you know, the 1960s and the boomer generation. So there's still some holdouts as far as the MLK debate goes. I want to discuss two of those. Which one do you want to tackle first? Samuel Say or? Let's do Samuel Say first, and then we'll do Christian Post next. Samuel Say is one of the authors of the Christian Post, but I don't think they actually pay him to write. So Samuel Say is, I am grateful for Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s fight against Jim Crow segregation. Christians can reject his liberal theology and his adulterous life and acknowledge his heroic advocacy against segregation. And, you know, that's a long-winded way of saying, thank you, Dr. King, that I can marry this white woman.
I mean, I got an article coming out about that in the near future. But, I mean, again, if we're just trying to talk about the Jim Crow segregation, I mean, it's kind of like Chesterton's fence, where we forget why those laws were enacted in the first place. We automatically attribute it to malice and, like, hatred and bigotry. But in reality, those laws were enacted because Irina Zarutska got slashed in the neck on a train. So therefore, they said, okay, you people have to go in your own separate car and away from our people. I mean, again, that's why those laws were implemented. And even Thomas Sowell talks about this in Discrimination and Disparities, where it was only after you had migration from the South to the North where, you know, you started having Jim Crow laws enacted in the North, which I think is the first Jim Crow laws actually were enacted in the North, or what they call Jim Crow laws. So a lot of it happened because of their behavior in a reaction to their behavior.
It's just ironic that, you know, Samuel Say is one of those people who claim to be not woke, but again, it's very clear. First of all, again, other than the fact that he's able to marry, you know, his wife, like, he has no real connection to the Black community in the United States, and therefore no real connection to the civil rights movement. I think that's very fair to say. Other than the fact that, you know, he can marry a white woman, there's not much connection that he personally has, because he was born in Ghana or whatever, moved to Canada, and then came to the United States on a visa because of marriage, right? You know, he got a marriage green card. So,
I mean, he's functionally.
It's not deep, but people in like, was it Will Spencer, I think? Someone brought him on as an interview to, like, talk about the Black community. It's like, the dude's not part of the Black community. His children might be able to assimilate into the Black community, but they won't. But he's not part of the Black community because he's African, like, actually African. But anyway, you know, Samuel Say, you know, celebrating the Godfather is my reaction. The 1960s CRM was the previous iteration of the 2020 Summer of Love, which, again, Samuel Say was supposedly on the right side of that issue.
And again, desegregation of schools was the worst policy for American education. Like, that destroyed the American schools.
And no one liked it either.
Yeah, I mean, again, if you...
Other than Kamala Harris, who claims that she enjoyed being... You know, she enjoyed the policy of busing,
which she didn't own
Joe Biden in a debate. Like, other than that, like, she's the one person that enjoyed the policy of busing. Like, Blacks and whites didn't like that. Moving on. It was readily obvious that, you know, and this is kind of the hot take, right? A lot of medieval hated and opposed critical race theory because they were afraid of being called racist, not because they opposed the ideology. And in Samuel Say's case, it is a meal ticket for him, because this guy is a shameless grifter who doesn't know. He just repeats other people's talking points. And, you know, it's just overall the point that Woke Wars 2 is the same war as Woke Wars 1. And that's not much has changed, really. It's the same war. It's just, you know, who are, you know, the heroes, the villains, and most of the sides, like, some people just switch sides. So, like the Italians in a world war, you just can't trust them. So there's another, the second part that I wanted to talk about, the second holdout, is Christian Post. So they wrote an article, and... Let me actually show you the article. So it was MLK Day and the March for Life, One Cause, One Dignity. And this article is just horrendous.
Who wrote it?
It was written by Mark Hancock, who I believe is associated with the Trail Life USA. So that's like a Boy Scouts alternative, if I recall. And he's, guest writing his preppy article and, you know, trying to March for Life post. Which maybe if I was more interested in, I could go to tomorrow, but I just, you know, who has time for that?
I know some people.
Oh, okay. I mean, I would totally like to do, like, man on the street things and see who's actually who's actually serious about pro-life and who's not. Like, I'd love to do that, but don't have time, and I don't really have, like, the equipment to do that properly. You know, like, I don't have, like, a hand microphone that plugs into my phone or whatever. Anyway. It talks about how the respect, you know, the whole premise of this article is that the civil rights movement and the pro-life movement are kindred spirits. And this is a very laughable premise. Then it talks about the American Revolution.
But that's not an unheard of premise, because you've heard for years, the abortion's the Holocaust of our era, abortion's the civil rights movement of our era. So, I mean, again, a lot of people on the right have used this sort of language to talk about that. And that's not to say that abortion isn't worse than the Holocaust, because it is.
Well, the point that he makes is that he draws it back to the American Revolution because both had to do with the dignity of life. It's like, No, they didn't. The American Revolution was not fought over the dignity of life. It wasn't. It was fought over, you know, who had the power of governance, Parliament or the king, and, you know, who was going to be the dominant legislative body in the colonies, Parliament or the local assemblies. So really, it was an anti-parliamentarian.
It was more of a secessionist movement.
Right. But it also would, the colonists would have been satisfied if we could have our charters and work with the king and not through Parliament, where we had no representation. So, but, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of the people who ran the revolution were people who financially benefited from skirting the laws of Parliament. That is also true as well. So they bring up the Gadsden flag and the history of that, which, by the way, the Peel to Heaven flag is the better flag. And then he ultimately connects the two and stuff like that. And it does not hold up as an article because the facts just don't align with that. So MLK was not actually pro-life, and there's no reason to think that he was pro-life. And I wrote this article for Tuesday. Martin Luther King Jr. was one of the first ever recipients of the Margaret Sanger Award by the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. A lot of people didn't know this. Like, I even did not know this, that Martin Luther King was a Margaret Sanger Award recipient. In fact, he was the inaugural one alongside Lyndon B. Johnson and a couple other people who you probably never heard of. So, it is wild, the fact that they actually did this. So I'll just read what I wrote. I also posted this on the Twitter sphere. The entire article is ironic, as MLK was not actually pro-life. Conversely, MLK was a staunch proponent of birth control and depopulation measures. In 1966, Planned Parenthood Federation of America, he got its first ever Margaret Sanger Award to honor the woman who founded America's family planning movement, given annually to individuals of distinction in recognition of excellence in leadership in furthering reproductive health and reproductive rights. His acceptance speech, titled Family Planning, A Special and Urgent Concern, delivered by his wife, Coretta King Scott, on his behalf, or Coretta Scott King on his behalf, emphasized the importance of birth control and population control. In it, he drew parallels between the civil rights movement and Margaret Sanger's work, stating, "There is a striking kinship between our movement and Margaret Sanger's early efforts." He argued that family planning was essential to combat poverty and overpopulation, writing, "Unlike plagues of the Dark Ages or contemporary disease, we do not yet understand the modern plague of overpopulation is soluble by means we have discovered with resources we possess." He further noted that unwanted pregnancies were a cruel evil needing control, and that Black Americans had a special and urgent interest in family planning for security and a decent life. So, along those lines, having read the speech, it's not a particularly long speech. Interesting fact, Planned Parenthood scrubbed it from their website. Just saying. The speech goes into, like, yeah, Black people, if they get kids and they don't want kids, are going to be economically hurt, and therefore we need to give them the means to not have kids and stuff like that. So, a lot of times when you think of the depopulation and eugenics movement and stuff like that, a lot of times it's like, I want the other people to not reproduce. But MLK was actually anti-Black in the sense that he wanted to put this on his own people to lower their birth rates, because they're also part of the depopulation problem. Because here's the thing about the depopulation concerns. It's all third world. Like, America was never overpopulated. But as far as, like, the world population goes, like, it's the third world exploding in population growth that is actually
overpopulated, like, in a problem.
That would be the more problematic of the population of the movement, because this was a moral debate at the time.
Well, yeah, I mean,
you know, if you go back to Star Trek and all that other stuff, Space Seed, very iconic episode. where, you know, there was a eugenics war. And the story of Khan, he's one, you know, iconic Star Trek villain. He was born out of the eugenics war. He was a superhuman, bioengineered to be superior in intellect and all these other things. And he was the one who got away, but he was also the one that was least tyrannical, and he was like the best of the rulers. Pretty ironic for a Central Asian figure, but anyway. And then he got away on the Botany Bay spaceship and was discovered by Kirk. But at the time, during the 1960s, they thought eugenics would be a much bigger debate than it turned out to be. It does seem like the good guys won on that side of the debate. And what's interesting is, like, Martin Luther King Jr. would have been on the wrong side of that debate. He would have been on the pro-eugenic side because he actually thought, incorrectly, that overpopulation was a huge concern.
Well, it's weird because, again, overpopulation is kind of a major concern when you're looking at, again, Africa, India, these countries that have ballooning populations that subsist off, you know, foreign money.
Well, it's a major concern when overpopulated areas don't produce their own food supply.
And again, that's, you know, where if America was to turn off the foreign aid faucet, then you're going to have a lot of problems, and particularly Egypt being one of them, but a lot of, you know, subcontinental Africa, which depends on, which I want to say the status, the continent, which I don't know if that includes Egypt or not, but they import like 80% of their calories. So again, that's a recipe for disaster. And it's the old adage of, like, you don't give, like, people free food because all you're doing is incentivizing overpopulation. You know, you feed the rats or whatever. You feed the wildlife, and all you do is end up with more wildlife.
So. Yeah, there's a lot of people who have cat problems because of that. But yeah, it's America. We grow our own food. We have the means. We are not overpopulated. Except in the sense that we have 100 million people that don't belong here, and that has caused a lot of issues because, you know, they're not counted for, and, you know, it's a little too fast in our, you know, it's an unnatural.
Oh yeah, because you're dumping people into the economy without actually building up your capacity to handle them, which is, again, same problem right. In Europe, where, you know, they don't have the house, they in Australia too, where they don't have housing to deal with all the people they just dumped into their country that don't belong there.
And it's entirely ironic to then argue, oh, MLK was pro-life, even though the guy was a staunch advocate of birth control.
Even still, his advocacy for abortion is still kind of almost a mainstream in the Black community today. But yeah, it might not be as tailored to, like, overpopulation concerns, but obviously they think, okay, having the child hurts the parents' ability to
work on their career.
Well, yeah, and that's
same argument from the speech.
I wonder if it's also tied to behavioral patterns that are more or less replicated today. Oh, out of wedlock births, that's harming people and harming their ability to advance out of poverty, which, again, number one thing to do to end up on welfare is to be a single mother. The single mothers are the biggest drain on the American people. It's not the gamer bros that are in their mama's basements or whatever that Mike Johnson talks about. And, you know, because they want to attack everyone but the single mothers. And I wonder if that's kind of his concern, is like, okay, we have all these single mothers because, you know, low time preference, low impulse control, temperamental, one night stands end up in a lot of illegitimate children. So I wonder if that is feeding into what that speech is talking about, not necessarily some master plan eugenics argument, but obviously, you know, seems like their solution is just throw more welfare money at it.
Yeah, I mean, I think he would have been on the wrong side because he thought depopulation was, like, the world was overpopulated. Because he thought that's why I would put him on the wrong side of the eugenics debate, where, you know, that's a Malthusian ethics thing. Like, you know, the whole, you know, the Thanos debate, like, Thanos was, you know, failed economics class, because when you have, you know, scarcity creates innovation. It leads to innovation. So tough times lead to innovation. The Germans starved after World War I, so they developed all these fertilizers that we still use today that are probably not good for you, right?
Well, you know, they're not good when they go wrong. That's when you see, like, a fertilizer plant explode. It's because you're taking, like, you're reversing an energy conversion to create the ammonia for the fertilizer. So you're reverse. So, you know, chemical reactions, there's a natural transfer of energy. If you're going the other way and that goes wrong, you end up with an explosion.
Yeah.
And that guy, I think, won a Nobel Prize. It's called Haber method, I think.
So. Right. So the point is that, you know, scarcity leads to innovation, at least among certain civilizations. America, we lead the way in innovation. We have invented some of the most important things. I was doing a homeschool lesson with my daughter and, you know, on American inventions, and because the book we were using neglected all the good ones. So it wanted to focus on blue jeans, which I don't care about because I don't like jeans. Hot take. But, or paper clips and stuff like that. Like, these are lame. America invented, like, some of the best things ever. The phonoscope, right?
Is that the original record player?
Yeah, like the original way to record sound. And the kinetoscope, the original way to watch a video. Because Thomas Edison didn't invent the motion picture. He invented the way to watch a motion picture. So, huge inventions. We invented air conditioning. We just made Arizona habitable. We made Florida a place that people would actually want to live. Because no one before air conditioning wanted to live in Florida. And then, first in flight.
And telegraph.
Yeah, and then first in flight. So, aviation. Like, a way to do that without blimps. Or hot air balloons. You know, not ways that I would want to travel across the world or, you know, fight in a war. You know, blimps and wars are a very bad idea for
reason. But America has a lot of helium, unlike Germany.
Yeah, I know. The humanity there. So anyway, Americans, we're an inventive people. We take risk and stuff like that. That's a heritage to be proud of. Just want to remind us of that. So overpopulation, I'm not overly concerned about, because we can invent things. But people who failed economics class, like MLK probably did, if he ever took it. Then again, he was a communist, so, you know. Economics is not his thing. They would not realize that, hey, humans actually innovate and, you know, when pressed. So, some closing thoughts, because I don't know how much. Actually, we can go into some chats to see if there's any questions. I thought I did see a question. Let's see. I'm late. Let's see. There's a question about who wrote the speeches. There's a question about, isn't Say from Ghana? Yes. Yeah, exactly. He's not a part of the American Black story. That was the point that I was making. Let's see. Definitely a good time for last call on questions, because I don't want to go particularly long tonight.
No, we did that last week with Joel Levin. So.
Oh, yeah. That stream went long, and, you know, even the year-end live stream went long. You know, we can go back to getting a little shorter on the live streams than we have been getting. That'd be nice. I'm going to try and book some guests on as well. I have some ideas. So, otherwise, oh yeah, we invented the internet. Very true.
Not Al Gore.
Exactly. Not Al Gore, but I believe the internet was actually invented a lot earlier than people think, but yeah. Yeah, America, we invented all the good stuff.
But we don't have culture.
Yeah, we don't. We don't have culture, yeah. So, anyway, I will give the Germans some credit, because I do think that Wernher von Braun was probably the greatest scientific mind of the 20th century.
And he knew the guy.
So, he's underrated in that category. Like, he was the greatest scientific mind of the 20th century, and, like, he's not a household name as much as he should be, because he's responsible for, you know, the space race and stuff like that. But anyway,
and you always see the picture that goes around where it's just like, oh, you know, all this money for NASA and, like, you know, children are starving because you can't afford to feed it. It's just like, yeah, because, you know, NASA and innovation is, like, cool, and, like, letting people be welfare queens is not. It's just dumping money on fire.
Yeah, and that's the David Platt argument. We should sacrifice generational wealth in order for Africans to eat for a week. That is the David Platt argument in Radical. So anyway, I'm sure he's a big fan of MLK. But other than that, like, the MLK tide in the church, I think, it's receding. And you're right, it was theological attacks first. You know, people that had a greater interest in this ahead of time, like Virgil Walker, Pulpit and Pen, and Dissenter, which at the time would have been Reformation Charlotte, I believe, all were MLK posting, like, 2018 and stuff like that. So, anyway, those are our thoughts for tonight. Have a blessed day. Stay based, and we will catch you on... Oh, Christ is King, and we will catch you on the next one. Can't forget that.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.